AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett and Eric with you on an Impeachment Tuesday. As President Donald Trump has had articles of impeachment drafted against him. As already, we might be seeing a few Democrats somewhat backing down from the impeachment proceedings, as this one kind of depresses me, as we already have a group of 10 Democrats that are floating the idea that instead of impeaching Donald Trump, we should just censure him instead, which seems very democratic of some of our lawmakers to do, in the sense that sometimes Democrats like to back down from some of the tough positions they take. Hopefully this doesn't gain any momentum. I'm kind of thinking it probably won't, because it would be a really, really bad look if you were to go in on these impeachment proceedings and then all of a sudden back down at the last second and say, oh, not anymore, I guess we'll just censure him. But there's a group of 10 guys, they're all men, by the way, who won in districts that Trump won in 2016, that are floating the idea of censuring Trump instead of actually impeaching him, which, yeah, to me just seems like a really lame strategy. I don't know about you, Eric, because that just seemed like the ultimate back down.
Yeah, it seems like moderate Democrats are ultimately the worst negotiators of all time.
Oh, totally.
Because they'll immediately compromise on points that were never even asked of them and just start working their way down. Like, actually, we'll just do this, but we only need to do this, and they don't realize that the other side's going to be unhappy with them no matter what they do. It's just so why don't you aim for something high, and then maybe we'll get half of that. I don't know.
You actually summed it up perfectly right there. The problem I have with moderate Democrats and moderates in general is not necessarily the policy positions they actually take, but as you said, they are experts at negotiating with themselves. They always negotiate against themselves, as you're talking about. They'll bring up arguments that the other side could conceivably make against them and end up, well, negotiating against themselves. That's kind of almost what we saw back during the Obamacare debate, where we saw some of the Democrats in the House and the Senate doing that same thing, saying, well, if we go with this provision of a public option, some Republicans might not actually support it, when, as you said, they're going to vote for it no matter what. Exactly.
And I think it's – so, okay, they're moderates. And they'll say, like, the truth is always in the middle or something like that. But they don't understand that they define those parameters.
Yeah.
So if you're always moving to the right, the middle keeps going to the right.
Yeah, when you start with your position as being to the right of center, then all of a sudden the so-called middle also shifts to the right as well.
Eventually it's just going to be like, let's draft a formal letter to Donald Trump to say, cut it out.
Wag our finger at him and say, don't do it again, Mr. President. In fact, we won't even censure you. We'll just send you a strongly worded letter that says, if you promise to never negotiate and blackmail a foreign government again, well, we'll not impeach you. And if you do again, well, then we'll send you an even stronger worded letter.
And that sounds ridiculous, but if the Democrats initially were proposing a censure, I'm sure those 10 would be actually advocating for that. Like, can't we just formally recognize?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, again, as I brought up, I never actually have a problem with the policy positions necessarily of moderates. It's, yeah, they're more negotiating skills. For instance, if you had moderate Democrats that actually stuck to their original positions, like take the public option, if we actually had Joe Biden or Pete Buttigieg or name your other so-called moderate Democrat say, all right, the public option is the position I'm taking and I'm not going to budge from that whatsoever, I would actually, yeah, very much be on board with their policy positions, because
if you could
the public
believe,
option would be a great idea, but they're just going to move away from it gradually.
If you could believe that they were actually going to stick with that, absolutely. But you know from previous experience, they never do. They'll always compromise on it.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we already see, going back to the impeachment idea, 10 Democrats somewhat moving away from the idea, although ultimately there's probably going to be enough pressure on them where I would say 8 or 9 of those guys are probably going to ultimately vote for impeachment, with the exception of a few, including, well, Colin Peterson. Although, interestingly, Colin Peterson was not among this group of 10 Democrats. He's probably in the even more so-called moderate position, where he doesn't want to have impeachment at all. In fact, when he was actually asked about this the other day by CNN, he basically literally said before he walked on the floor, I have no idea what's happening. That was his entire position. I have no idea what's happening. Talk about trying to actually...
That's an incredible defense.
Yeah, yeah. What's your defense, Mr. Representative Peterson? Well, I have no idea what's happening.
Come next election cycle, he'll just play that ad. Like, see, I'm not responsible for voting to impeach. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I had no idea what was happening. Hey, by the way, so we expect, of course, the impeachment proceedings to actually move on into the Senate. And we've heard some talk about what Republicans might actually do when this moves on to the Senate. And are they going to call people like Hunter Biden, or they would probably find a way to try to subpoena Hillary Clinton as well if this actually moves. Well, it will move to the Senate floor. But there is a problem with trying to actually get someone like a Hunter Biden as a witness on the Senate floor. And I didn't know this until I did a little research. You actually need to subpoena someone onto the Senate floor during the Senate trial proceedings 51 votes. And of course, Republicans already have 53, or only have 53 votes. So they could only lose 2 votes before they would not be able to get Hunter Biden or whoever else they want. And I absolutely hope they try this, because I absolutely want to see a Susan Collins or a Joni Ernst or a Tom Tillis, or who's the guy in Colorado, Cory Gardner, is just absolutely squirm as they're facing their tough reelection campaign, sitting there and thinking, oh my God, do we really actually want to bring Hunter Biden onto the Senate trial floor? Which I would say, vote for it. I think that would be a fun spectacle to actually see them subpoena Hunter Biden and just have it blow up in their face.
Huge fan of Hunter Biden. He's one of the only things I like about Joe Biden is that he has a cool son.
Yeah, his son is unabashedly, I don't know the word to describe him, but just unabashedly not the smartest
flawed
guy. Flawed, yes. Yeah. That's the word I'm looking for.
It seems like he has demons. He seems like he wants to be a good person, but he just can't get in front of himself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he doesn't really hide it at all either. But the Republicans do need actually 51 votes in the Senate to get someone subpoenaed. So I'm looking forward to when they actually try to get someone like a Ted Cruz or a John Cornyn, trying to convince their caucus, saying, "Hey, let's bring Huma Abedin to the Senate floor. Let's bring Hunter Biden to the floor. Let's bring Hillary Clinton to the floor." Just thinking of every name they can possibly bring to the Senate trial floor, and just seeing some of these senators who are facing tough reelection campaigns sit there and squirm and try to figure out how they should vote on that issue. All right, so coming up, the rest of the show is actually going to be pre-recorded, as I do have a couple of interviews lined up. Coming up next, we're going to be speaking with Eric Black of MinnPost and talking about Gerald Ford's position on impeachment and what high crimes and misdemeanors actually mean. Then later on, we'll talk more impeachment with Jeremy Vanuk of the Moscow Project, talking about Ukraine in detail. That's all on the way here on our 4 o'clock show. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson on the 4 o'clock show. Of course, a big day in U.S. politics, as we do have articles of impeachment that have been drafted against President Donald Trump. And joining us now on the program to talk more about that and other topics related to impeachment is Eric Black of MinnPost, who covers politics and government both in Minnesota and the United States, as well as the historical background of political topics and other issues. So, Eric, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure to be with you.
So, let's start with a big topic, of course. We do have those articles of impeachment which were drafted today. So, at least in your eyes, were there any surprises in terms of what articles were drafted against specifically the president?
Not particularly. The number of the articles isn't that important to me, and I'm sure it's all being decided on a strategic basis. But we've been hearing for some time that the two subjects of the two articles were the main two things that were going to be included.
Absolutely. So let's move on to a little bit of the history of impeachment with the framers, because basically they described it as being treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And you went through and actually read the book, which I'd highly recommend reading as well. It looks like I haven't read it myself, but the way you laid it out sounds like it's a good read. It's called High Crimes and Misdemeanors, A History of Impeachment for the Age of Trump, written by Frank Brown III. So as you read through that book, what exactly did the framers mean by the misdemeanors part of that aspect? It was kind of borrowed from British law, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, the whole phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors, was lifted from a number of British cases. And it was the last phrase imported into the impeachment clause after some others had been in and out over the course of the drafting. And the fact that they lifted this phrase from a number of impeachment cases that had occurred in the British Parliament makes it pretty clear that they were trying to get the meaning that the British had used. I think Americans first hearing it, especially that word misdemeanors, which we think of as like jaywalking, makes us wonder whether it means everything from a serious case of treason or bribery to jaywalking, but it doesn't. High crimes and misdemeanors refers to improper acts by the person being impeached that represented an abuse of their high office, and that's what the high is doing in that phrase. And crimes and misdemeanors doesn't really just mean anything from murder to jaywalking, but it does mean abuses of office, especially for one's personal benefit. And those were the examples of reasons for which the British Parliament had removed officials in their cases, including in some cases where no actual crime had been committed, but an abuse of office had been committed.
And going back to what you were saying, yeah, they drafted the way that a president can be impeached, not necessarily to mean a specific crime that you would be convicted of in a court of law. As you basically say, in kind of a colloquial sense, it actually means bad behavior.
That's true, and serious bad behavior, and especially bad behavior that represents an abuse of the powers of the office.
Then we have kind of an interesting history as well when it came to impeachment and the way that the framers were deciding how a president should be impeached, because there were a couple of other pieces of language which actually didn't make it into the Constitution, and that would be maladministration and corruption. Can you talk a little bit about both of those and possibly why the framers ultimately decided not to include both of those aspects specifically in a way a president can be impeached?
Yes. Well, I learned all of this from Professor Bowman's excellent book, but there were several drafts of the language. So everybody who's paying attention knows this phrase now, high crimes and or treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. But there was an earlier draft where there were four specific criminal acts specified. I forget what the third and fourth ones were, and they decided that was too specific, and at one point they changed the third phrase to maladministration, treason, bribery, or maladministration. And then somebody among the framers said, we don't really want these presidents to be removed just because they have a policy dispute with Congress. Maladministration is too broad. And at that point they settled on this phrase, which they borrowed from the British, high crimes and misdemeanors, which, as I mentioned previously, refers to improper use of power for a corrupt end.
Boy, and I can only imagine in today's political climate the amount of havoc that would be wrecked on our government if we actually still had maladministration as an impeachable offense, especially during our very polarized political times. I would probably be thinking we'd see just about every president possibly being impeached just for so-called maladministration. But let's move on to another aspect that you talked about in terms of this idea of what exactly high crimes and misdemeanors are. And that's actually according to a guy who, of course, was very important in the 70s. That would be President Gerald Ford, who took office after Richard Nixon. And the idea that he was trying to bring up in terms of high crimes and misdemeanors actually has to do with what he talked about when he was still serving in Congress, when he was trying to impeach a Supreme Court Justice, William Douglas, for basically writing opinions about issues such as pornography that, well, didn't exactly thrill a lot of politicians. So can you talk a little bit about that and how Gerald Ford basically had kind of his different interpretation of what high crimes and misdemeanors actually were?
Yeah, well, in my piece, I mentioned that over the years, when people have raised this quote from Gerald Ford, including me, it was almost in a derisive way. What Ford said, he was trying to impeach Justice Douglas because Justice Douglas was very liberal, and Ford was specifically offended by Justice Douglas's toleration of pornography as a First Amendment matter. And that was why he wanted to get rid of Justice Douglas. And when people would say, well, he hasn't committed any high crimes, Ford, on the floor of the House, he was a House member, a high-ranking member of the Republican House leadership, he said, high crimes and misdemeanors means whatever a majority of the House says it means at a given point in time. In other words, it doesn't have any other meaning than we got a majority of votes to say this was it, and that's all it means. And in the past, when it's been quoted, it always seemed like it was really kind of dumbing down the constitutional language, basically saying it's just a partisan vote. If we can get the votes, it doesn't matter whether it meets some definition of those words. That's what it means. It means whatever a majority of the House says was a high crime and misdemeanor, then it was. And as I say, in the past, it seemed like that was sort of a violation of our understanding of the separation of powers. But as we approach the current moment, it's pretty obvious that the votes are dividing almost exclusively on a partisan basis, with relatively little concern about what the meaning of those words are and what the meaning of the various alleged actions of the president that have brought us to this point are. And almost everybody is going to vote the party line. And it occurred to me that although I mocked Ford in the past for saying it was whatever we say it means, it really is. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how convinced someone might be that the allegations against President Trump don't constitute high crimes and misdemeanors. What matters is that the Democrats control the House and they've got the votes, and the Republicans control the Senate and they've got the votes. And as far as we can tell from where we are right now, it looks like the overwhelming majority of members in both houses are going to vote the party line. It's not really the way it was designed to work, in the sense that when the framers were imagining the system, they didn't even have national parties. They weren't assuming this level of partisanship. But it's what we have now, and it made me think that what Ford said back then is pretty much true. We're having an argument every day in the news about whether these particular actions constitute appropriate high crimes and misdemeanors, but basically it looks like almost every member of Congress is going to vote the party line in both houses.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, as you talked about, it might not be exactly how the framers intended it, but essentially with the language they drafted, yeah, it's essentially how it works today. And it gets to another idea that you wrote about in MinnPost, Eric Black, and that is this idea that we technically don't have co-equal branches of government, because we often hear that quoted from different people saying, well, we have co-equal branches of government that put checks and balances on each other. And that's not really the case, because if you look at who can actually be removed from office, it's actually Congress that, of course, can remove the president. But when it comes to members of Congress actually being removed, well, they actually have to do that amongst themselves, which kind of shoots down this whole idea that, yeah, both or all branches of government are created equal, because that wasn't the intention when, of course, the Constitution was originally drafted, and that hasn't necessarily been the case in practice as well.
Yeah, well, there are some things that could certainly be called checks and balances, but the idea that the branches are equal, and I think as it has evolved, you could say that it's become much more equal. But if you were to go to the original plan and look at it with fresh eyes, you would say, well, who's got the power? And the Congress had almost all the power. They were going to make the laws. And the sections of the Constitution that outline the powers of the Congress are long and specific about the powers that they had. The sections laying out the powers of Congress are three or four times longer in the Constitution than the powers of the president. The framers were reluctant to create the presidency. They were nervous about it because they were leaving a king system and they didn't want to have a king. So they wanted to make sure if they had somebody who had executive authority, that the powers would be sufficiently circumscribed. And if you think about it, this is stuff everybody really knows. What are the president's powers? He can veto a law, but the Congress can override it. So that would be a perfect example of how, on the question of what should be the law, it was basically up to the Congress. There was no suggestion at that time that the president was going to be the leader of a party that might have the majority in one house or the other, and that he would be telling them what laws to create. The president was expected to make a decision about whether a particular law that they had proposed was good or bad or violated the Constitution or didn't. But the ultimate power on what was going to be the law was in Congress. The president was commander in chief, but they were not picturing a permanent military establishment of the sort we have now. But in time of war, they certainly wanted the president to be in charge of the military. But if you actually read the Constitution and look at the powers that were specifically assigned to Congress, and then look at the comparable section for the president, it's pretty obvious that they were not thinking in terms of equal branches. They certainly had separate branches, and there were some checks and balances built in. But the Schoolhouse Rock version that we were all raised on of co-equal branches was nothing they could have imagined. And by the way, the same would be true of the third branch, the Supreme Court. The power of the Supreme Court to strike down laws is not specified in the Constitution and probably wasn't even contemplated.
We've been speaking with Eric Black of MinnPost, who covers politics and government here in Minnesota and also at the federal level at the United States. And he is also someone who writes about the historical background of topics and other political issues. So, Eric, really appreciate you taking the time to join us today on the program.
It was my pleasure.
And coming up next, we'll continue our discussion about impeachment and the articles drafted today against President Trump with Jeremy Vanuk of the Moscow Project, as we're going to take a deeper look into what actually is in those articles of impeachment and some of the conspiracy theories we're likely to see floated once, of course, we have that inevitable Senate trial. But first, let's get to the news from Public News Service. Welcome back to AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you on the 4 o'clock show. Well, of course, a big day in Congress as we officially had articles of impeachment drafted against President Donald Trump. And joining us now to talk more about those articles of impeachment and also Ukraine and Russia is Jeremy Vanuk. He is with the Moscow Project and is a research analyst with that organization. And he joins us now on the program. Hey, Jeremy, how are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Hey, so before we get started, can you tell us what exactly the Moscow Project is and what you guys do?
The Moscow Project was set up back in early 2017 as kind of a way to track everything that was going on with what at the time was the Russia investigation. It sort of shifted gears now to be about the Ukraine investigation. And we've been trying to compile kind of the complete record of what's been going on. You know, analyzing everything as it comes in can be a really daunting task just because there's something new every day. Sometimes there are several new things every day, as in, I don't know, today or yesterday. So we've been trying to keep on top of it and really make sure that we can cut through the smoke and the dust that surrounds these investigations and really give a clear picture of the Trump administration's basically ongoing attempts to undermine American democracy with foreign governments.
Yeah, absolutely. And even I'm trying to follow along with these investigations, and yeah, it's tough to keep these names straight. Who's who, what happened with what scenario. Yeah, definitely glad you guys are doing that work over there so we can kind of keep things straight in terms of what's actually happening with all of these ongoing investigations. Because, man, I'm even thinking back to the Bush years of the 2000s and thought those investigations were ongoing with scandal after scandal after scandal. But, yeah, the Trump administration certainly is kind of taking this to a whole nother level compared to what we had during the Bush years.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, yesterday and today are a perfect example. First, you have a hearing that details really extensive evidence of the fact that Trump basically extorted the Ukrainian government, that he withheld first a White House meeting and then military aid from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky until he announced investigations of Trump's political opponents. And then on top of that, you had the Inspector General's report, which effectively debunked a conspiracy theory that Trump has been spreading for more than 2 years now, which is that the Obama administration somehow illegally spied on or surveilled his campaign. The Inspector General's report came out, completely debunked that conspiracy theory, and yet you still have Trump, and now in an interview that is literally happening, literally airing as we speak, Attorney General Bill Barr continuing to push that conspiracy theory and say that the report basically said the opposite of what it said.
So let's move on to the actual articles of impeachment that were drafted today, because basically they have to do with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. So, Jeremy, were there any surprises for you in terms of these articles that were drafted against Trump? Did you expect any more to be included, or were you surprised that maybe there was more included than you thought? What were your overall thoughts and takeaways thus far?
One thing that I think is notable about the articles of impeachment is that they don't just call for the impeachment and removal of President Trump. They call for him to be impeached, removed, and barred from seeking or holding future office. That's something that differentiates it from the impeachment articles that would have been pursued against Richard Nixon. It is something that was in the articles of impeachment against President Bill Clinton, but that's something that I was surprised to see. One thing that I was unsure if we would see, I wouldn't say I'm surprised, but it's interesting to note that they don't explicitly make a case for obstruction of justice with the Mueller investigation. And that suggests that Congress is going to continue on the somewhat narrow path that they have defined over the last several weeks, really hammering the Ukraine stuff, really hammering the overwhelming evidence of Trump's misconduct when it comes to Ukraine, but not necessarily bringing in his other corrupt and, some would argue, I would certainly argue, impeachable offenses in other realms.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question to bring up, at least strategically. Could Democrats possibly be making a mistake by essentially not including really anything about the Mueller report in those articles of impeachment? Because at least strategically, you could sit there and say as a Republican that, hey, even the Democrats are admitting that nothing was wrong with the Mueller report and Trump did no wrong with Russia. Do you think they possibly could be making a mistake by not including anything about the Mueller report in those articles?
I think that House Intel Chairman Adam Schiff gave an implicit argument for that particular decision in this morning's press conference. He really stressed that the people who are saying, why don't Democrats wait, why don't they build a fuller case, are really saying, why don't we allow Trump to just continue to cheat in the next election? And by saying that, I think he kind of gives a window into the decision to not include the Mueller investigation in the articles of impeachment, which is that this is about the next election. This is about Trump's efforts to subvert democracy, to stay in power, to avoid accountability, to win the future election. And in doing so, I think Democrats will, in one way, kind of avoid some of the allegations that they're just constantly relitigating 2016 and are focusing instead on what Trump has done in office and how that will affect things moving forward.
So as we probably will expect, the impeachment will probably move to a full Senate trial, and we're likely to hear as a defense many more of these conspiracy theories that have been floated by the Trump administration and Republicans. And one of the ones that really caught my eye here, Jeremy, and this strikes me as being really dangerous, is that they keep floating this idea that it was actually Ukraine who was trying to interfere in the 2016 election. And not only were they trying to interfere, they were trying to do it on behalf of Hillary Clinton. And basically, and you can talk more about this, this is straight from actual Russian propaganda.
That's right. And the Senate has reportedly been briefed on the fact that these talking points come from Russia. We saw memos from the Mueller investigation that basically documented that the Trump campaign heard this conspiracy theory first from Konstantin Kalimnik, who's suspected of being a Russian agent. He was indicted for some of his work alongside Paul Manafort. And it's really important, I think, to stress that this is entirely mutually exclusive, with the understanding that Russia hacked our democracy in 2016, that Russia was behind that attack. Because Republicans have tried to launder their talking points into, well, there was an op-ed once that might have angered Trump and a Ukrainian-American contractor at the DNC. That's not what Trump and Giuliani and John Solomon and these others have been pushing. They have been pushing this broad conspiracy theory that Russia didn't hack the DNC. The server was sent to Ukraine to cover something up. They're hiding it. Joe Biden got the prosecutor fired, not just to protect his son, but also to cover up whatever it was that the DNC had done with its server that it sent to Ukraine. And this is just a flat-out conspiracy theory. Even the Republican witnesses, people who still work in the Trump administration, who were called before Congress to testify, said that this thing, whether or not Trump actually believes it, is a straight-up conspiracy theory.
One of the other defenses we're likely to hear is that, well, the Ukrainian government actually didn't have any awareness that their aid was being held up to basically investigate Joe Biden's son. And of course, we've heard multiple times during the hearings in the House this was not the case. It sounds like Ukraine actually had knowledge about this much earlier in the summer. They didn't just find out about it in September. So can you talk about that aspect a little bit in terms of how Republicans might say, well, this is perfectly fine because Ukraine didn't even know that their aid was being held up?
The evidence goes back showing that Ukraine may have even known that aid was being held up on July 25th. On the day of Trump's phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Laura Cooper, I believe, who was a Pentagon official, testified that she received an email on that day about aid being held up to Ukraine, about questions of whether Ukraine would be getting the aid that they were congressionally slated to receive. We have a Ukrainian official who told the New York Times recently that she was aware as early as late July. This notion that Ukraine somehow didn't know that they were being extorted is simply nonsense. The message was delivered over and over again, both that military aid was being withheld and that Trump was demanding this investigation. That was on the front page of the New York Times. Rudy Giuliani told the New York Times all the way back in May that Trump wanted Ukraine to investigate his political opponents. And then, of course, Trump himself said it on the White House lawn. So there's really no question that Ukraine understood that aid was being withheld, that the White House meeting was being withheld, and that the Trump administration's demand was for them to open investigations into Trump's political opponents.
Well, let's talk about Rudy Giuliani a little bit more here, because as I was reading through in the Moscow Project, you guys are talking about how while Rudy Giuliani was, of course, pushing, you know, for on behalf of Donald Trump in his kind of extortion scheme, he might have also had his own interests at play as well. Can you talk about what possibly Rudy Giuliani would be looking at in terms of his own interests just beyond helping Donald Trump?
Absolutely. And this gets to an important point. Trump's defenders are saying that he was sincerely concerned about fighting corruption in Ukraine. All of the evidence shows that Trump and his team were, in fact, fostering corruption in Ukraine. Giuliani was palling around with these two Soviet-born Florida businessmen, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, and it looks like they were pursuing corrupt schemes for their own profit in Ukraine. Parnas and Fruman, it appears, were angling to get Ukraine to replace members of the board of its natural gas company in order to swing very lucrative liquefied natural gas deals with them. There's even some instances where it appears that this is linked to an indicted Ukrainian oligarch named Dmitry Firtash. He has been fighting extradition to the U.S. for years now. He's living in Vienna, and Parnas and Fruman appear to have been working on his behalf in pushing these schemes. And it looks like Giuliani may have been involved in those schemes as well. We know that there is a federal investigation that involves looking at him not only for the Ukraine scandal as we know it in terms of efforts to interfere in American democracy, but whether he may have been part of that corrupt business scheme as well.
And of course, another person who could be implicated in this as well is one of the staunchest Trump defenders in Congress. That would be Devin Nunes, who appears to actually have had contact with a couple of these Rudy Giuliani associates who were later indicted. So he could certainly be in some trouble as well.
This is one of the more alarming things in the House Intelligence Committee's report on the Ukraine scandal, is that Devin Nunes appears to have exchanged at least four phone calls with Lev Parnas, one of those Soviet-born indicted businessmen who was running their corrupt schemes in Ukraine. And it's not just that. There's been reporting in CNN and the Daily Beast and other outlets that says that Parnas is willing to testify that his involvement with Nunes, his interactions with Nunes and his staff went significantly further than the American people currently know. Now, Nunes denies it. He's, in fact, suing, I believe, CNN for more than $400 million to dispute the claims. But that suggests that somebody who was partially in charge of running the Ukraine investigation may have himself been a fact witness, if not directly implicated, in this behavior as well.
It overall just looks like an overwhelming crime ring with the number of people who have been implicated in all of these schemes. Is there any other names we should be bringing up that we should probably be talking about as well? Because one name I don't often hear, and it looks like he's also been very involved in this, is Mike Pence. Can you talk about that or some other people who aren't getting a lot of attention in the media that are very involved in this whole conspiracy and kind of crime ring?
Pence has basically spent 3 years trying to avoid being implicated in any of Trump's scandals, and this looks like the one that may finally catch up to him. Sondland, for example, testified that Pence was one of the people who was in the loop on the Ukraine extortion scheme, that Pence was updated at least once, if not more times, on the investigations that Trump wanted Ukraine to pursue. There's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who, again, appears to have been updated at least once, if not multiple times, about Trump's extortion scheme and was actually listening in on the July 25th phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. And then there's Bill Barr, who is, again, currently giving an interview in which he just said that he doesn't think that there's sufficient evidence to say that Ukraine didn't interfere in the 2016 election. Trump explicitly invoked Barr on that phone call with Zelensky, told Zelensky to call Attorney General Barr to talk about these investigations. Barr was specifically named in the whistleblower complaint and yet has not recused himself from anything to do with the Ukraine investigation. And now he is once again carrying the president's water, giving this interview again just today, in which he repeats the president's favorite conspiracy theories in direct contravention to all of the evidence in front of us.
And one final point to bring up here, Jeremy, before we do have to wrap things up, is that I think ultimately what we're going to hear in the Senate, especially from a lot of Republicans, is that we don't have the full smoking gun, in the sense we don't have Trump admitting on tape that he was trying to bribe and extort Ukraine, and we don't have the actual audio from the phone calls. But there's so much circumstantial evidence, and even that's how it works in the criminal justice system. You don't need a direct, red-handed confession. All you need is just a whole lot of circumstantial evidence to basically prove your case. And that certainly appears to be the scenario we're running into with Trump and Ukraine, where we have just an overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence that points to the fact that, well, he was basically bribing the Ukrainian government.
Right. And I would actually say that there have been smoking guns. The July 25th call, Trump's announcement on the White House lawn that he wanted Ukraine to investigate the Bidens, Mick Mulvaney's press conference. There's so much smoke from all the guns that it's hard to see the guns. But on top of that, the reason that there isn't more firsthand testimony, the reason that there isn't more smoking gun evidence, if that's what Republicans really want of Trump's wrongdoing, is that the White House has been blocking any evidence from coming forward. They've blocked at least a dozen witnesses, at least 10 of whom received congressional subpoenas to appear before Congress. They're refusing to release thousands of documents. I believe it was the House counsel, Goldman, who said yesterday that he would love to have the problem of having to sort through all of the documents that they've requested from the White House to see if there was, in fact, a smoking gun of the president's behavior in there beyond the ones that we already know about. But the White House, I would say, seems to be aware that releasing that testimony, releasing those documents, would only further incriminate the president and his inner circle, and is doing everything it can to make sure that Congress does not see that.
Absolutely. We've been speaking with Jeremy Vanuk. He is a research analyst with the Moscow Project and has been following this investigation closely, what's been happening with the Ukraine, and also, of course, prior to what's happening with Russia as well. Hey, Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find more information about Jeremy's work and the Moscow Project overall at, well, aptly named, themoscowproject.org. We'll come back on the other side of the break and wrap up the show with a few final thoughts. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Welcome back to the 4 o'clock show with Brett. Final segment of the show, and do want to preview what will be happening the rest of the week. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have Professor David Schultz of Hamline University on, as we're going to be talking about Democratic impeachment strategy, as things will likely move on into the Senate in the coming weeks. Then on Thursday, an interview with Jet Heer of The Nation magazine about a topic that really fascinates me, because we often hear as a political narrative is that it's the extreme left and it's the extreme right, of course, using the word extreme in quotes, that are pulling our country towards authoritarianism. That's often the narrative we hear. But is it actually moderates who could be pushing the country towards authoritarianism? We're going to have that conversation with Jeet coming up on Thursday. And then on Friday, I'll actually be out of town, but Ellie Krug of Ellie 2.0 Radio will be filling in for me for a live show, so that'll be your opportunity to speak with Ellie. So tune in for that coming up on Friday when Ellie fills in for me. That's all the time we have for today on the program. I'll be back with a live show tomorrow, again, joined by Professor David Schultz.